B2, Task 1. Instructions. Listen and complete the sentences 1 to 6 according to what the speaker says. The speaker uses different words to those that appear in the answers. You must choose one answer from the three options given for each question. You now have 1 minute to look at the sentences.
Paul Quadracassis is from the London-based investment banking firm Aqua Partners, and he's been looking at the economics and the likely growth trajectory of in vitro meat.
There is a willingness now, as we've seen in the last 5 or 10 years, for consumers to try new types of foods and food produced by new methods. This meat would have a longer shelf life. You can add vitamins and minerals. It reduces greenhouse gases. You can eliminate E. coli and other bacteria. And probably, at the end of the day, the thing that will matter most are two things, taste and cost. If you, a consumer, can eat a hamburger that tastes at least as good as the one you've always eaten, and you can buy it at a lower cost, then you're probably, over time, going to want to eat that burger. And when you have so many other reasons that I've described that makes sense for the world to pursue this artificial meat, then you start to see how this can become a reality. With artificial lab meat, technology and science will find a way. And in fact, I would look at this and you look at this and say, it's quite amazing how advanced some companies already are. So Beyond Meat, for example, is already selling a burger in 600 Kroger stores in the U.S. and over 300 Whole Foods stores. And these burgers aren't that bad because people are buying them and eating them. There have been studies done that it's not so much the vegetarians that are interested in the, you know, whatever you want to call it, a veggie burger or an artificial burger. It's the existing meat lovers and people eating meat and hamburger who are looking for a healthy alternative. And that number is growing, and I don't have the statistics in front of me, but it's quite a large percentage of people. I think only 8% in the latest study I read would not be interested in trying a different form of meat. And I think that could be the most significant statistic, is that meat eaters today are open-minded about trying a new form of meat. It's not going to be an overnight thing. It's a development that will happen over time, but there will be a period of time, whether it's a year or 2 years, where there will be quite intense disruptive change. And it will inevitably dramatically affect farmers around the world and farming. And I actually had a conversation with the CFO of a very large company involved in the fertilizer business recently. And we discussed this, and he basically acknowledged that, yes, if this, let's call it in vitro or lab artificial meat, were to have a massive presence on the shelves, it would be the beginning of the end of their whole customer base, farmers who need fertilizer. And I think that's the way to look at this. It isn't just one sector. It's not just the meat processors, but it's the entire ecosystem. It's the farmers, it's the fertilizer, it's the supermarkets, it's everyone. And that, you know, that is a big number, and it has massive implications, and it's going to happen. It's just a question of when.
Thank you, Paul. That's Paul Quadracassis from Aqua Partners in London. Paul Quadracassus is from the London-based investment banking firm Aqua Partners, and he's been looking at the economics and the likely growth trajectory of in vitro meat.
There is a willingness now, as we've seen in the last 5 or 10 years, for consumers to try new types of foods and food produced by new methods. This meat would have a longer shelf life. You can add vitamins and minerals. It reduces greenhouse gases. You can eliminate E. coli and other bacteria. And probably, at the end of the day, the thing that will matter most are two things, taste and cost. If you, a consumer, can eat a hamburger that tastes at least as good as the one you've always eaten, and you can buy it at a lower cost, then you're probably, over time, going to want to eat that burger. And when you have so many other reasons that I've described that make sense for the world to pursue this artificial meat, then you start to see how this can become a reality. With artificial lab meat, technology and science will find a way. And in fact, I would look at this and I do look at this and say, it's quite amazing how advanced some companies already are. So Beyond Meat, for example, is already selling a burger in 600 Kroger stores in the U.S. and in over 300 Whole Foods stores. And these burgers aren't that bad because people are buying them and eating them. There have been studies done that it's not so much the vegetarians that are interested in the, you know, whatever you want to call it, a veggie burger or an artificial burger. It's the existing meat lovers and people eating meat and hamburger who are looking for a healthy alternative. And that number is growing. And I don't have the statistics in front of me, but it's quite a large percentage of people. I think only 8% in the latest study I read would not be interested in trying a different form of meat. And I think that could be the most significant statistic, is that meat eaters today are open-minded about trying a new form of meat. It's not going to be an overnight thing. It's a development that will happen over time, but there will be a period of time, whether it's a year or 2 years, where there will be quite intense disruptive change. And it will inevitably dramatically affect farmers around the world and farming. And I actually had a conversation with the CFO of a very large company involved in the fertilizer business recently, and we discussed this. And he basically acknowledged that, yes, if this, let's call it in vitro or lab artificial meat, were to have a massive presence on the shelves, it would be the beginning of the end of their whole customer base, farmers who need fertilizer. And I think that's the way to look at this. It isn't just one sector. It's not just the meat processors, but it's the entire ecosystem. It's the farmers, it's the fertilizer, it's the supermarkets, it's everyone. And that, you know, that is a big number, and it has massive implications, and it's going to happen. It's just a question of when.
Thank you, Paul. That's Paul Quadracassus from Aqua Partners in London.
B2. Task 2. Instructions. Listen carefully and complete the statements 7 to 11 below with one or two words according to what the speaker says. The wording of the sentences below may be slightly different from what you hear. However, the words you write must be exactly the same as what you hear. You now have 1 minute to look at the sentences.
And cholesterol, how do I know if my cholesterol is high? Is it because I'm fat?
The truth about cholesterol is you can't tell by looking at someone. You must go and get it measured. And what's more, don't settle for a single number, because cholesterol's not about numbers. In fact, it really is important to know the breakdown of the so-called LDL, lousy bad cholesterol, and the HDL, which Ian Marber calls his happy cholesterol, to get your risk right.
Right. Now, I mean, is this anybody, everybody over the age of...
All right, everybody over the age of 40. And the government guidelines are very clear. If you're 40 or over, you are entitled to have this checked up. If, however, you are at risk, and it's really important to say cholesterol by itself doesn't tell you your risk. You can have a normal cholesterol and be at high risk of heart disease, or you can have a high cholesterol and be at low risk. And I looked at the evidence very, very hard to see what makes the difference. And we found out that for example, the six foods that the UK Cholesterol Charity highlight, that we've highlighted, which really do lower cholesterol, and the evidence of the kind of diet based on the Mediterranean diet that we all know about that helps. But the point about it is, how much of it do you need, and how do you build it into your normal food?
Right. What about the other foods that we should be eating?
Oats. They're really good. You need about 3 grams of what they call the beta glucans, which is the good bit in oats, and you get that from a bowl of porridge. We need fibre, lots and lots of fibre. We probably eat half the amount of fibre.
OK, but is that brown bread?
Sadly, no. Oh. An awful lot of brown bread is actually white bread with a bit of caramel colouring in it.
So where do I get my fibre from?
Grains, pulses, nuts. They really, really are a superfood. Snack on them. People worry because they're high calorie, high fat, but they make you eat less. And actually, there's evidence that you lose weight.
Are we talking peanuts here?
Peanuts aren't technically a nut, but they act in the same way. They have roughly the same kind of...
So they won't do you any harm, certainly. What about meat? How much meat? How many eggs in a week?
Eggs are off the danger list. You can have eggs. Don't worry about them. In terms of saturated fat in meats, the evidence is not clear. Keep it down. Twice a week, red meat.
And really briefly, statins, yes or no?
If you need them because your risk is high, don't treat numbers, treat your risk.
That's the voice of Laura Corr, a consultant cardiologist. And cholesterol, how do I know if my cholesterol is high? Is it because I'm fat?
The truth about cholesterol is you can't tell by looking at someone. You must go and get it measured. And what's more, don't settle for a single number, because cholesterol's not about numbers. In fact, it really is important to know the breakdown of the so-called LDL, lousy bad cholesterol, and the HDL, which Ian Marber calls his happy cholesterol, to get your risk right.
Right. Now, I mean, is this anybody, everybody over the age of...
All right. Everybody over the age of 40. And the government guidelines are very clear. If you're 40 or over, you are entitled to have this checked up. If, however, you are at risk, and it's really important to say cholesterol by itself doesn't tell you your risk. You can have a normal cholesterol and be at high risk of heart disease, or you can have a high cholesterol and be at low risk. And I looked at the evidence very, very hard to see what makes the difference. And we found out that for example, the six foods that the UK Cholesterol Charity highlight, that we've highlighted, which really do lower cholesterol, and the evidence of the kind of diet based on the Mediterranean diet that we all know about that helps. But the point about it is, how much of it do you need, and how do you build it into your normal food?
Right. What about the other foods that we should be eating?
Oats. They're really good. You need about 3 grams of what they call the beta glucans, which is the good bit in oats, and you get that from a bowl of porridge. We need fibre, lots and lots of fibre. We don't eat, we probably eat half the amount of fibre.
OK, but
we
is
should.
That brown bread?
Sadly, no. Oh. An awful lot of brown bread is actually white bread with a bit of caramel colouring in it.
So where do I get my fibre from?
Grains, pulses, nuts. They really, really are a superfood. Snack on them. People worry because they're high calorie, high fat, but they make you eat less. And actually, there's evidence that you lose weight.
Are we talking peanuts here?
Peanuts aren't technically a nut, but they act in the same way. They have roughly the same kind
of...
So
they won't do you any harm, certainly. What about meat? How much meat? How many eggs in a week?
eggs are off the danger list. You can have eggs. Don't worry about them. In terms of saturated fat in meats, the evidence is not clear. Keep it down. Twice a week, red meat.
And really briefly, statins, yes or no?
If you need them because your risk is high, don't treat numbers, treat your risk.
That's the voice of Laura Corr, a consultant cardiologist.
Task 3. You will hear Celeste Headlee at a TED Talk giving 5 tips on how to be better conversationalists. Instructions. Choose which comment, A to F, corresponds to each tip. The comments have been mixed up, rephrased, and summarized. There is one extra comment you do not need to use. Write your answers on answer sheet 2, task 3. You now have 1 minute to read the questions.
Number one, don't pontificate. If you wanted to state your opinion without any opportunity for response or argument or pushback or growth, write a blog. You need to enter every conversation assuming that you have something to learn. The famed therapist M. Scott Peck said that true listening requires a setting aside of oneself. And sometimes that means setting aside your personal opinion. Bill Nye. Everyone you will ever meet knows something that you don't. I put it this way, everybody is an expert in something. Number two, use open-ended questions. In this case, take a cue from journalists. Start your questions with who, what, where, when, why, or how. If you put in a complicated question, you're going to get a simple answer out. If I ask you, were you terrified? You're going to respond to the most powerful word in that sentence, which is terrified. And the answer is, yes, I was, or no, I wasn't. Were you angry? Yes, I was very angry. Let them describe it. They're the ones that know. Try asking them things like, what was that like? How did that feel? Because then they might have to stop for a moment and think about it. And you're going to get a much more interesting response. Number three, go with the flow. That means thoughts will come into your mind and you need to let them go out of your mind. We've heard interviews often in which a guest is talking for several minutes and then the host comes back in and asks a question which seems like it comes out of nowhere or it's already been answered. That means the host probably stopped listening 2 minutes ago because he thought of this really clever question and he was just bound and determined to say that. And we do the exact same thing. We're sitting there having a conversation with someone, and then we remember that time that we met Hugh Jackman in a coffee shop. And we stop listening. Stories and ideas are going to come to you. You need to let them come and let them go. Number four, don't equate your experience with theirs. If they're talking about having lost a family member, don't start talking about the time that you lost a family member. If they're talking about the trouble that they're having at work, don't tell them about how much you hate your job. It's not the same. It is never the same. All experiences are individual. And more importantly, it is not about you. You don't need to take that moment to prove how amazing you are or how much you've suffered. Somebody asked Stephen Hawking once what his IQ was, and he says, I have no idea. People who brag about their IQs are losers. Conversations are not a promotional opportunity. Number five, all of this boils down to the same basic concept, and it is this one. be interested in other people. You know, I grew up with a very famous grandfather, and there was kind of a ritual in my home. People would come over to talk to my grandparents, and after they would leave, my mother would come over to us, and she'd say, "Do you know who that was? She was the runner-up to Miss America. He was the mayor of Sacramento. She won a Pulitzer Prize. He's a Russian ballet dancer." And I kind of grew up assuming everyone has some hidden amazing thing about them. And I think it's what makes me a better host. I keep my mouth shut as often as I possibly can. I keep my mind open, and I'm always prepared to be amazed. And I'm never disappointed. You do the same thing. Go out, talk to people, listen to people, and most importantly, be prepared to be amazed. Thanks. Number one, don't pontificate. If you wanted to state your opinion without any opportunity for response or argument or pushback or growth, write a blog. You need to enter every conversation assuming that you have something to learn. The famed therapist M. Scott Peck said that true listening requires a setting aside of oneself. And sometimes that means setting aside your personal opinion. Bill Nye, everyone you will ever meet knows something that you don't. I put it this way, everybody is an expert in something. Number two, use open-ended questions. In this case, take a cue from journalists. Start your questions with who, what, where, when, why, or how. If you put in a complicated question, you're going to get a simple answer out. If I ask you, were you terrified? You're going to respond to the most powerful word in that sentence, which is terrified. And the answer is, yes, I was, or no, I wasn't. Were you angry? Yes, I was very angry. Let them describe it. They're the ones that know. Try asking them things like, what was that like? How did that feel? Because then they might have to stop for a moment and think about it. And you're going to get a much more interesting response. Number three, go with the flow. That means thoughts will come into your mind and you need to let them go out of your mind. We've heard interviews often in which a guest is talking for several minutes and then the host comes back in and asks a question which seems like it comes out of nowhere or it's already been answered. That means the host probably stopped listening 2 minutes ago because he thought of this really clever question and he was just bound and determined to say that. And we do the exact same thing. We're sitting there having a conversation with someone and then we remember that time that we met Hugh Jackman in a coffee shop. And we stop listening. Stories and ideas are going to come to you. You need to let them come and let them go. Number four, don't equate your experience with theirs. If they're talking about having lost a family member, don't start talking about the time that you lost a family member. If they're talking about the trouble that they're having at work, don't tell them about how much you hate your job. It's not the same. It is never the same. All experiences are individual. And more importantly, it is not about you. You don't need to take that moment to prove how amazing you are or how much you've suffered. Somebody asked Stephen Hawking once what his IQ was, and he says, "I have no idea. People who brag about their IQs are losers." Conversations are not a promotional opportunity. Number five. All of this boils down to the same basic concept, and it is this one. Be interested in other people. You know, I grew up with a very famous grandfather, and there was kind of a ritual in my home. People would come over to talk to my grandparents, and after they would leave, my mother would come over to us, and she'd say, "Do you know who that was? She was the runner-up to Miss America. He was the mayor of Sacramento. She won a Pulitzer Prize. He's a Russian ballet dancer." And I kind of grew up assuming everyone has some hidden amazing thing about them. And I think it's what makes me a better host. I keep my mouth shut as often as I possibly can. I keep my mind open and I'm always prepared to be amazed. And I'm never disappointed. You do the same thing. Go out, talk to people, listen to people, and most importantly, be prepared to be amazed. Thanks.
B2, Task 4.
You will hear three independent extracts on unrelated topics. Instructions. For questions 17 to 22, choose the correct option A, B, or C for the two questions of each extract. The speaker uses different words to the options that appear in the questions. You will hear each extract twice.
Extract 1. You now have 20 seconds to look at Extract 1. Extract 1. You hear a woman talking about ethical hacking.
You might have heard of several cyber attack cases where companies have lost their crucial data, money, reputation, and customer trust. These attacks are carried out by hackers who exploit weaknesses in a computer network to gain unauthorized access to vital information. However, hacking is not always bad, as there are hackers who work with different motives. White hat hackers, also known as ethical hackers, hack with permission to defend an organization. This form of hacking is legal. It is known as ethical hacking. Ethical hacking is distributed into six different phases. The first phase is reconnaissance, where you collect all the required information. Next is the scanning phase, where you try to spot any system vulnerability. Following this is the gaining access phase, where the spotted vulnerabilities are exploited. In the next stage, known as maintaining access, you try to maintain your access for future attacks by installing backdoors. The fifth phase is clearing tracks, where you clear all the evidence of the hack, and finally, in the reporting phase, you document the summary of the entire attack.
Now, listen to Extract 1 again.
You might have heard of several cyber attack cases where companies have lost their crucial data, money, reputation, and customer trust. These attacks are carried out by hackers who exploit weaknesses in a computer network to gain unauthorized access to vital information. However, hacking is not always bad, as there are hackers who work with different motives. White hat hackers, also known as ethical hackers, hack with permission to defend an organization. This form of hacking is legal. It is known as ethical hacking. Ethical hacking is distributed into six different phases. The first phase is reconnaissance, where you collect all the required information. Next is the scanning phase, where you try to spot any system vulnerability. Following this is the gaining access phase, where the spotted vulnerabilities are exploited. In the next stage, known as maintaining access, you try to maintain your access for future attacks by installing backdoors. The fifth phase is clearing tracks, where you clear all the evidence of the hack, and finally, in the reporting phase, you document the summary of the entire attack.
Extract 2. You now have 20 seconds to look at Extract 2. Extract 2. You hear a man talking about John Cordwell, a British businessman.
John Cordwell was raised in a home with few material comforts in the industrial town of Stoke-on-Trent in the English Midlands. His father died young. John learned early about the importance of economic self-reliance. His breakthrough moment came in the 1980s when he spotted the potential of mobile phone technology and set up a business buying up some of the earliest clunky handsets, at a discount and selling them on at a handsome profit. The seeds were sown for a business eventually branded as Phones for You, which became a dominant player in the UK with millions of customers and a market value at the time he sold it of some £1.5 billion. His business success and the eventual buyout made John Cordwell one of the richest men in Britain. For several years, he was the highest income tax payer in the whole country. He's acquired all the trappings of the super rich, the mansions, the yacht, the Ferraris, but he's also devoted a huge amount of his time and money to philanthropy.
Now, listen to extract two again.
John Cordwell was raised in a home with few material comforts in the industrial town of Stoke-on-Trent in the English Midlands. His father died young. John learned early about the importance of economic self-reliance. His breakthrough moment came in the 1980s when he spotted the potential of mobile phone technology and set up a business buying up some of the earliest clunky handsets at a discount and selling them on at a handsome profit. The seeds were sown for a business eventually branded as Phones for You, which became a dominant player in the UK with millions of customers and a market value at the time he sold it of some £1.5 billion. His business success and the eventual buyout made John Cordwell one of the richest men in Britain. For several years, he was the highest income tax payer in the whole country. He's acquired all the trappings of the super rich, the mansions, the yacht, the Ferraris, but he's also devoted a huge amount of his time and money to philanthropy.
Extract 3. You now have 20 seconds to look at extract 3. Extract 3. You hear two women talking about TV and its impact on school grades.
First, as students go back to school after the seemingly endless summer holidays, many parents and teachers may be wondering whether the way teenagers spend their leisure time is having an impact on their exam grades. New research from the University of Cambridge suggests that this may be the case, with TV watching in particular having a dramatic impact on how well students perform in their GCSEs. Ginny Smith went to talk to Kirsten Corder at the MRC Epidemiology Unit to find out more about how they made this worrying discovery.
We measured the physical activity and sitting behaviours of 845 teenagers when they were 14 and a half years old. We followed them until they were 16 when we got their GCSE results. What we found was that higher TV viewing, internet use and computer games use was linked with lower grades. So for example, every extra hour of television viewing at age 14 and a half was linked with two fewer grades at GCSE. So for example, dropping from an A to a C. However, we found, as you might expect, that more reading and more homework was linked to higher grades at GCSE. But interestingly, this was only up to 4 hours a day. If the students spent over 4 hours a day doing reading and homework, we found that it was linked to actually grades dropping again afterwards.
Now, listen to extract 3 again.
First, as students go back to school after the seemingly endless summer holidays, many parents and teachers may be wondering whether the way teenagers spend their leisure time is having an impact on their exam grades. New research from the University of Cambridge suggests that this may be the case, with TV watching in particular having a dramatic impact on how well students perform in their GCSEs. Ginny Smith went to talk to Kirsten Corder at the MRC Epidemiology Unit to find out more about how they made this worrying discovery.
We measured the physical activity and sitting behaviours of 845 teenagers when they were 14 and a half years old. We followed them until they were 16 when we got their GCSE results. What we found was that higher TV viewing, internet use and computer games use was linked with lower grades. So, for example, every extra hour of television viewing at age 14 and a half was linked with two fewer grades at GCSE. So, for example, dropping from an A to a C. However, we found, as you might expect, that more reading and more homework was linked to higher grades at GCSE. But interestingly, this was only up to 4 hours a day. If the students spent over 4 hours a day doing reading and homework, we found that it was linked to actually grades dropping again afterwards.